Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. There's a new band in town, and you can tell a lot about it just by listening. It's big band enough to evoke the 1930s and 40s, but this is 2018, so the pianist in Bill Banfield's Imagine Orchestra, last time I heard it, was a young Cuban woman, and the solo star, also a woman, was a jazz violinist. Berklee College of Music students sit next to old pros in this band. You hear hip-hop floating through it, and a lot of jazz knowledge popping out of it. A quotation right here from Herbie Hancock's Maiden Voyage. This is composed music that makes room for improvisation and virtuosity. The Imagine Orchestra draws on vernacular sounds of church and street. You get touches of the avant-garde and Africa. Long after jazz joints disappeared, you can feel again a community of musicians reaching out and enveloping its audience.
Well, the conception is to imagine an orchestra that is both traditional jazz, it's orchestrated, but it also is a made up of virtuosos. All of my players in my orchestra, the Imagine Orchestra, all of them are killing, as the kids say.
Our guest Bill Banfield imagined the Imagine Orchestra. A guitarist to begin with, he's a composer now of symphonic music that's been played all over the U.S. He's an historian of the band leader Sun Ra and his orchestra. He's got a novel forthcoming about a musical dreamer growing up, as Banfield himself did, in Detroit in the Motown era. The book is called Cedric's Truth, a novel by a musician. And Bill Banfield is the chair of Africana Studies at the Berklee College of Music.
One of the things that I was brought there to do is to help institute cultural studies, which is an area of arts and thinking and aesthetics and culture, and teaching young people artistic citizenry, which means they have to look at their past. They have to be concerned about where they are in the condition of their times. And they have to use their gifts to perform and provide a service to people that allows you to go towards the future, to the next steps.
Where are they coming from? What is the dream? Who are the heroes?
Well, that's the thing. They're coming from all over the world. You got, remember, an entering student body of some years, 1,000. So you got 1,000 kids from all over the world.
Right.
And they want to be like Beyonce. They want to be like whoever is on the charts, whether it's Chance the Rapper or Adele or whatever. They are there because they want to aspire to be something. But they come there to learn. So the job of the institution is to teach them the history, the culture, to prepare them to be better citizens and better musicians. And that's quite a challenge, because the way in which the larger culture defines all those things are through these things that are very quick and fleeting and popular and cool and swag. And those things are okay, but they don't really define what it is to be a musician and an artist and a citizen.
Have they heard of Quincy Jones, who went to Berklee? He might have been in the first class, but in the 50s.
Sure. They know of Quincy Jones, because Quincy is one of the big ones. He connects to The Wiz and Michael Jackson and The Fresh Prince and all along. So he's one of the core figures, and he had that kind of great experience where he came there as a young person who wanted to be trained in music and had the skills and wanted to increase those skills. And so Berklee does have that part of a great history in its core. So they start thinking of themselves in the longer haul of someone who could contribute with their music and their soul and their intellect and their questions.
What about their chops? What about their reading skills?
Oh, well, no, chops. Listen, somebody said to me a long time ago, the gene pool for talent has not gone out in the human race this generation. Now, as a matter of fact, they've got more stuff
in music
to do
chops,
with.
Probably.
Oh, they've got great chops. They've got great ways to express their chops. They've got tools to be able to project their chops. The challenging issue is the why for the chops. Why do you have this gift? And what can you do with it that connects to the greater cause of what artistry is about?
In your novel, Bill Banfield, Cedric, sounds a lot like Bill Banfield, keeps talking about the ghosts, listening to the ghosts. Ralph Ellison called them the ancestors.
Yeah.
And he always said he liked the ancestors better than he liked the cousins and aunts that were still here among us. When you talk ghosts and what they're saying to your students, where does it begin?
Let's go back to culture. So all of my music as an artist, my education, my interest are based on the idea that culture is supposed to capture the time, captivate, critiques the time. And if you go back to the role of the West African griot, which is where I start with my students, I say, we are all griots. So they say, griot. They learn about the West African musician who is a storyteller and who is a historian and who is a culture bearer and who is accountable to the community and then has to learn their craft to be able to carry all that accountability and weight and meaning and art. So we start there. Sama jas nang mari jas nunggu ni jen sama ka desa kemari dia gua njubuh musang mas njubuh jom mas mpaya mu sama jas mu jik mat bodi bus bujur kapas desa sampai piru gyo di salu mla
Griot, the word that Alex Haley introduced in the TV series Roots a million years ago. The elder, the storyteller, the homer of the village, etc.
That's correct. But you get your information from the griots, from the ghost. And you get that information also from older people. And you mix that up with their wisdom, the community's wisdom, what the ancestors are telling you, and then you become that energized, that informed soul now. I think the thing that I find most of my students saying to me, to Dr. Banfield, I never knew that Africa and African traditions played such an important role in what music has come to be. That's their surprising thing, because they see James Brown, they see Tupac, they see India Irie, they see all of these people, Duke Ellington, Sarah Vaughan, all of them, all up to current. But they never make the connection backwards to see how those things, they talk about this in terms of the African retentions in the diaspora, those ghosts you talk about, those traditions, those threads to tradition, and then the rebooting and the reworking to those threads is what we have to teach young people. Yeah.
I met one certified griot, Kunimo, in Ghana, and he talked about it.
Started with Nyonkro. Nyonkro means songs for nation building. Just listen to one song. You go and sing.
I think that's when you teach the tradition of the griot, you take students back to listening to West African traditions. We're finding that even the roots, all of us are being disconnected from the roots.
Amen.
And the griot's role, no matter where he or she shows up, is to keep us connected back to those essential cultural roots. Sona Jobate from the Gambia. She says, we don't write books. We create songs of our beliefs, our values, our heritages, our cultural history. She is from a longstanding griot family of hundreds of years and one of the first women from that tradition that went public as a griot. Really wonderful. Was with my students just the other day. She sang the tradition. She talked to them about the challenges of the modern griot. And so what's great for me, I think, is we've been talking about the griot. I make my students say, I am a griot. And this past week, a contemporary, incredibly powerful griot who has traditions of hundreds of years in her family, who are trained musicians, who go out in the world and to, you know, imbibe the community with those traditions and sing them in songs. She's real.
Kids get it?
Oh, yeah, they get it, particularly because she has YouTube videos too. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it connects with the tradition and contemporarily, she's in the culture and being presented in that way. So they definitely got it.
The mark of Bill Banfield, says the Boston church musician Jonathan Singleton, is his calm navigation through the many musics out there. Church and dance, African American and European, some ancient, some being born.
I think the thing that really strikes me about him, the thing that really makes him unique as an artist, is his really deep and profound understanding of the intersectionality of all the artistic disciplines of fine art, music, various styles of music, genres and cultures, whether it's his jazz playing or his opera composing or his big band composing or his speaking or his preaching or his sermons or any of those aspects. He always manages to bring in all these things together in a very, very truly unique way.
Coming up, what Bill Banfield means by leaving room for the ghosts in the making of new music. This is Open Source. It is doctrine, of course, in Bill Banfield's Africana studies at Berkeley that the music comes out of the mother continent. Banfield himself comes out of one particular and rich American time and place.
You know, we're talking about griotism, Chris, and I come from a great city. I'm not ashamed of that. A great, great city.
Jeez.
And a great industrial city that defined American values and American hard work and American innovation. And it also helped to define American arts, particularly American music and popular music particularly. Mm. Although, but that includes gospel music traditions. It includes art music and classical traditions. And it definitely includes the core of what Motown is about, which is the sound of young America. So Berry Gordy's vision of taking young kids who were around him and creating a multi-million and billion-dollar kind of product that made a mark on the world as the sound of young America. So you got the Temptations and the Supremes and Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So I'm very proud of that part of my American and Detroit heritage. So it meant a lot. I went to a school called Cass Tech High, which Jerry Allen went to, and, you know, Regina Carter, and all these great musicians who are a part of that trajectory of training. Ron Carter went there, the great bassist, as you know.
I was going to say, I'm older than you, but when I think Detroit music and jazz, I think of the amazing Jones
Brothers. Of course,
Brothers,
Jones Brothers, of course.
Hank Jones.
Absolutely.
Elvin Jones, Thad
absolutely.
Jones.
They're all there. And then we had great teachers in jazz. I think one of the things that you and I are talking about in terms of my identity as a composer, I had to bring all those things together. We had the Detroit Symphony there. We had gospel music tradition. We had Motown. And we had jazz. We were trained in school to bring all those languages together. So Detroit for me means this great cosmopolitan, great city with great history, with all these griots that were going out in the world, studied, but yet bringing the popular meaning of our lives together in the contemporary song and groove.
Like, would we call Michael Jackson a griot? A modern
griot? Oh, absolutely.
Griot?
I mean, man in the mirror, come on. I mean, take a look at yourself and ask these questions about yourself and then take responsibility and be the best man or person or lady in that mirror to project outward. That's a major griot song in my mind.
It's gonna feel real good. Gonna make a difference. Gonna make it right.
That's a wonderful example of Man in the Mirror, but other examples?
I think in terms of artistic griotism, I think someone we lost recently is Jerry Allen. Jerry Allen was a trained musician from Detroit who went through that high school and then immediately, not immediately, after some years, went into her artistry. And then in the years of New York, hanging out with the jazz musicians that created, you know, all kinds of new approaches compositionally and playing. To Jerry Allen as a leader, not only artistically, but in terms of what she represented as a person. So when she died about a year ago, we were devastated to lose Jerry Allen. I think there were many musicians that came through Detroit that we trained under. Marcus Belgrave is our great griot. He trained a lot of the musicians. He was a great jazz, not only performer, but teacher. One of the things that I talked to you a little bit about, I think that's important, that artistry tries to break, is the box that the mainstream culture paints us all in. What artists hate is that box.
Talk about it.
That box says you are black, you are purple, you are gay, you are American, you are this. I mean, what is that? I mean, that's somebody's prescription. I think the big thing that we're angered by is how the media defines what black and blue and green and purple is. But the people define, the people's spirit defines what humanity is. And I think the great thing that we get from musicians and artistry is they teach us how to dance and to poem and to sing and to paint new boxes of identity. And so, yeah, I do have a black identity as a man, as a human, as a someone who came from my mommy and my daddy. And my culture has a very important part of that, to defining who I am as a black American, as a black artist. So here I am, a young person, trying to figure out what that is. But that blackness also has to do with me seeing a painting in a new way through my experience. So I think that the great thing about culture and for artists, which is why you have to appreciate them, is they're constantly redefining those boxes in provocative ways and important ways, which is linkages to those griots, those cultural foundations, but it's also springboards into new experiences. So the definition of being who I am is widened and deepened and throws reflective notions about what that can become. That's the role of art. And what we fight against is, I think, the poisonous prescriptions that the media and the mainstream industry put out there.
Think of three artists, Bill Banfield, who taught you something, musically or humanly or otherwise.
I think that's a difficult question, Chris. I have to think about artists in my experience growing up. Let's just freestyle for a minute. Duke Ellington.
Praise God.
Look, my mother, when she was 14, went to hear Duke Ellington. And at the start of their second set, he came out to her and said, "What would you like to hear this evening, little lady?" Mm. My mother brags about that, or bragged about that, and well into her middle 80s. Duke Ellington said to me, "What would you like to hear this evening, little lady?" And so that connection with my mother, and then what he projected as this great griot that carried the culture of elegance and eloquence, and he defined what black people needed to do, or what black people were capable of doing. So his whole way of orchestrating his music, which was inspirational to me in terms of cultural forms, projections of ideas, but look at what he did with his music in that orchestra. He had these guys and ladies that were telling stories, black, brown, and beige, you know what I'm saying? You know, sophisticated lady, you know, it don't mean a thing if it what? If it ain't got that, you tell me.
Swag.
There you go. If it ain't, now the young people today say if it ain't got that swag. But swing and swag is about the same thing, right?
It don't mean a thing. All you got to do is sing. It makes no difference if it's sweet or hot. Just keep that rhythm, give it everything you got. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
You got to have that swing in the world, baby. You got to know how the beat goes. You got to know how the motion of the people go. You have to know how the music moves. But the whole
idea. I remember Duke standing in front of the band and telling, coaching people how to snap.
How to snap. How to be cool.
On the two and the four.
How to move your head.
But the one and the three.
That's right. That's
considered square.
That's right.
And aggressive.
That, there you go. I love that film.
And the boys in the band want you to know they do love you madly.
Yeah, right. Stuff. I think he was an example of that. But totally. He was a great thinker, a cultural griot. He was also stylish, so he had contemporary relevance. But then there were great classical composers like Stravinsky, who also looked to black music, was transformed by it when he got to America. And so here we have the black griot tradition that is an important tradition for Western composers. You know, say, listen, Dvorak said, "I'll teach you Americans how to have a great culture, but guess what you got to look to first? You got to look to black people.
Black songs.
Oh my goodness, and those traditions." So he said, you got to have some black people and black culture in your music. You got to have Native American culture in your music. And I'll come here and teach you how to run your American conservatory, but I need to have one. He's saying this in 1893 now, Anton Dvorak. "I'm going to come and help you run your American conservatory, but I got to have one-third black students." He's saying this in 1893. "I got to have one Native American students, and then the rest of your population, the other third." Who is everybody else? You know, I mean, those numbers are a little off, but they constitute great streams of cultural peoples that landed in this culture. So Stravinsky came here and said, "Look, I'm going to do ragtime music."
I think of Charlie Parker also breaking out spontaneously in Rite of Spring. It was all part of his head.
Yeah, he's studying bebop. "What are you looking at now?" And he's studying the Rite of Spring. And he's studying Stravinsky. Gunther Schuller told me once when I was interviewing him that one of the things that Charlie Parker was angry at is, why didn't you guys tell me about these guys? He said, I would like to be studying Stravinsky as I'm creating bebop. Bebop is one of the great musical signs. I mean, bebop is as cool and complicated and conscious in terms of construction as a Bach fugue. If you're a composer and musician, you don't know how difficult a Bach fugue is and how constructed it is. And it still has all that joy and love in it, but it is an exercise in how line against line works. When you listen to bebop, it is that kind of intricacy in terms of its construction that's conscious. And it has this other element to it, which is you got to know the changes. You're going to be a great bebopper. So like Duke Ellington said, you know, you don't mean a thing if it ain't got the swing. Well, the bebopper said it don't mean a thing if you don't know the changes. You got to know the changes, baby. And when you know the changes, then you've got, you know, the art, you know, the culture, but then you also know the intricacy of how those changes are constructed.
Duke and your mother reminds me so clearly. 1999, 100 years after Duke's birth,
yeah.
He did two or three shows about him, and a day or two later, getting off the B car, going out to WBUR, a very prim, very Boston black lady just walked past me, didn't say a thing till she had passed, and then said, "Thank God for Duke Ellington."
Yeah, thank God for Duke Ellington. And you know what? That's one of the things that we say to young people. We say, you have to have some thank God for them moments. And that could be Kendrick Lamar for them. And it could be Beyonce's Lemonade. Thank God for Beyonce's Lemonade.
Mm.
Because she helped us to see, it will, from her grandmother, who's a great griot now, in a tradition, right? That, baby, you got to turn your lemons into what? Lemonade. These young people have great cultural icons and moments to look at, but we're constantly telling them that you got to look at the moments that have meaning.
You're reminding me also of Miles Davis, a generation after Duke Ellington, and they were not great soulmates by a long shot,
sure.
But Miles said eventually, what if we just had a big party and said thank you to Duke Ellington?
Yeah.
But you know, it reminds me also, there was a biologist, MIT-trained biologist, teaching at Brown, I got to know pretty well, and we used to hang out and talk about all kinds of stuff. But eventually he said to me one night, we would talk about biology too, but he said, you know who inspires me year after year? I said, who? He said, Miles.
Yeah. Miles, let's talk about that in relationship to one of the things you and I've been doing. And I appreciated you and your team coming out to Scullers the other night. To hear the,
what a pleasure.
To hear the Imagine Orchestra. Now, I created the Imagine Orchestra around the premise that you need to imagine what this music could be. You need to imagine what jazz could be if it did the griot thing, if it connected to those traditions, if it connected to the relevancy of today, and if it could project what should be the music for tomorrow. So you have someone like Miles Davis, who is an innovator in every decade that he lived in, that he may work music. From the beboppers to free jazz to, you know, to modal jazz to then all the way up to, you know,
all the
hip-hop. Fusion, all of them. I mean, he listened to Jimi Hendrix. He listened to Prince. He listened
to
the rappers.
He wanted to be Prince at the end.
He wanted to be Prince. He wanted to be the rapper, like the rappers. So there is a notion of innovation. So the Imagine Orchestra, the concert that we did the other day, was about imagining that. And we had young people in that orchestra. People who look to those griots like Regina Carter, and we had Regina Carter, who's the great violinist of our generation, play in that orchestra as a guest artist, along with Rachel Z. These are our contemporary. Well, they're my age. We're still contemporary. We don't believe we've gone away yet. But we look to Miles Davis, and we look to Sarah Vaughan, and we look to Duke Ellington as the model, but we also project forward. So you got to look at Robert Glasper, you got to look at Esperanza Spalding, you got to look at all of these ways in which these artists are doing that. That's what I try to create in my orchestra.
I want you to talk about it. It was so fascinating to listen to. You heard so many old strands of more Ellington than a Basie band.
Yeah,
it was a individuals band.
Sure.
Not a 4/4 time band,
right, right.
But terrific variety, lots of women, young people, some knew each other from way back, some probably were meeting for the first time that night. And I wonder, how in the world did you, what's the conception?
Well, the conception is to imagine an orchestra that is both traditional jazz, is orchestrated like you might understand Maria Schneider, or you might understand Gil Evans, or you might understand Ellington. It's orchestrated, but it also is a made up of virtuosos. Mm-hmm. All of my players in my orchestra, the Imagine Orchestra, all of them are killing, as the kids say, or jazz musicians say. They're killing, which means that I've got two or three Cuban musicians who are at the top notch of their artistry.
Lady pianist, remarkable.
Oh, yeah. She's Zaylee Gonzalez Zamora is absolutely brilliant. She played my piano concerto in Cuba with the leading Cuban orchestra today, the leading all-women's orchestra there. And so I met her in that looking at Cuba and going back and forth. And she came to me and we talked about it. So I said, would you play in my orchestra here? And so that's a young person who's schooled and trained. Then we've got someone like a Regina Carter we've talked about from Detroit, from Cass Tech, who was the guest artist that night. And all of those younger violinists want to be just like Regina Carter. Mm. So I think that Quincy Jones model, that Ellington model, that Griot thing we've been talking about is what I was trying to do with the Imagine Orchestra.
Coming up, the feeling of community that seemed to disappear with the jazz joints. Or did it? This is Open Source. Regina Carter is a MacArthur-certified genius on the jazz violin. She went to Cass Tech High School in Detroit and then the New England Conservatory alongside Bill Banfield. When I asked her to hum a few bars of the music Bill wrote for her as a teenager, she took the bait.
Yeah, let's see. Da 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 da. Oh, wait, scratch that.
I love it.
I got a better idea. Hold on. Part of the melody there. The thing about those tunes that Bill and everyone was writing back then, they were really interesting. They were journeys. And we weren't just playing jazz, we were playing everything, because then no one was telling us that you can only play jazz, or you can only play this, or you can only play, you know, there wasn't this division that we seem to have in music now. And our radio stations, WJZZ, you just hear an array of styles.
You're lucky kids. When you think of Bill Banfield over the decades, who is Bill Banfield?
Who is Bill Banfield? I just hear that laugh. Bill's never content, which is a good thing. He's always searching. He's always reading, discovering. He's very, very involved in community, always interested in working with young people.
Regina, I sense there's a project there, a Bill Banfield project.
Bill has projects. He has so much music. He's written European classical works for symphony orchestras. He's written arrangements and works for people like Sweet Honey in the Rock. Bill has a lot of musical interests, and he doesn't box himself in. He just likes to create.
Regina, we watched you, heard you, standing with your violin in front of his Imagine Orchestra. What does that feel like?
It was a lot of fun. It brought back a lot of memories. It reminded me of our days as youngsters, being in someone's basement, backyard, garage, rehearsing, and just seeing Bill in his element. You know, here he is with this huge group of musicians. Mm. He's managed to pull off all of this music. Everyone's excited to be there and play it. Just to see, he's like a kid in the candy shop. It's like, wow.
Bill That was the modern jazz master on the violin, Regina Carter. Bill Banfield's lightly fictionalized version of himself in the novel Cedric's Truth is a rebel musician on the run. He's fired by a longing for old values that used to seem normal, and equally for new visions, new outlooks.
One of the things that Cedric talks about is making sure you leave enough room for the ghost to enter in. You got to leave enough room and music to have those ghosts whisper to your ear. So there's you have to have great players in an orchestra. They have to know the tradition. They have to read the music. But the improvisation and the collective wisdom of that improvisation is what creates that great element that you can't get from the Boston Symphony. Listen, I love the Boston Symphony. I grew up as a kid here loving and listening to Boston Symphony and wanting to write for the Boston Symphony. I taught for the Boston Symphony when I was a young college student here. But the one thing that can't happen in the Boston Symphony, the first violinist is not going to get up and play the changes, you know, and he's not going to play with the bass player and the cellist, and they're not going to create a blues in that so that you can have a kind of a freestyle there, so all the artists are going to play, then they're going to get back to the notes again. That's not going to happen at the Boston or the Baltimore and the Detroit Symphony, but it does happen in Duke Ellington's band, and it certainly happens in my Imagine Orchestra.
No, it's funny. I copied that sentence out of your book. That's why you have to leave room for the ghosts.
Yeah.
Those things you have taken deep into your soul, the remnants of past inspiration who will instruct you and guide you.
You got that from my book?
I did.
Where's that coming from? Cedric?
Page 185.
Well, see, Cedric is the new novel. That's amazing. I forgot about that. That's a beautiful line. Say that line again.
That's why you have to leave room for the ghosts. Those things you have taken deep into your soul, the remnants of past inspiration, who will instruct you and guide you.
Wow, yeah. Cedric is killing. He's a guy that, to me, embodies the stuff that we've been talking about. Because Cedric is a musician who understands from what his past is, and what he embodied growing up in the 60s and 70s about, like you say, leaving room for the ghost, understanding your culture. And he goes crazy because every place he goes, they're not listening to the ghost anymore. They're only listening to what's the current cool thing. The NPR thing, right? Let's only report on what happened yesterday or today, and then we're on to the next. And Cedric's constantly saying, no, but the traditions are what inform me to be a musician. How am I going to go out and teach the world and change the world and transform the world if you don't allow me to be in the world, to hear the ghost and hear the tradition and to evaluate where we are?
Can I describe Cedric to you?
Please.
He's a runner traversing the worlds between the trap, the matrix, and the pursuit of truths.
Ah, yeah.
Bill, there's another piece of the Imagine Orchestra that I just wanted to note and sound you out on, and that is not the individuals, but the community.
Yeah. I think that we miss community play in art today because everything is so constructed and commercialized. You know, so I think the challenge is getting all those people there. The joy is creating a community so people can say, wow, that's cool. It's orchestrated. It's together. But it also has a freeing element, a freeing spirit. And that has to do with the sharedness, the sharing that goes on when you have a group, when you put it. I tell my students always do all your training and get all your skills together. But then guess what? Go out and start a band. There's no better way for people to project community than when you look on the stage and you can see four or five people singing and playing together.
I think all sorts of people miss the community sense, the local sense. I mean, the internet has kind of abolished geography, but particular sounds of cities, but neighborhoods, jazz joints to sound awfully sentimental about local expressive music, people sitting in. Wally is famously in Boston's
Wally's
place where, yeah,
sitting in and garage bands or bands. You're absolutely right. That's the thing that I think people will always need. You can go to YouTube all you want, but I tell you, at the end of the day, you want to go eat a sandwich and sit down. You want to hear some musicians, some poets, some rappers, some dancers up on that stage to lift your soul, lift your spirits. That's the role of the artist. And you can get that through the internet all you want, but there's nothing like going and hearing some live musicians playing, some live poets and some live dancers.
It was easy when we were growing up. My brothers and I, 50 years ago, our favorite spot in Boston was Connolly's.
Yeah,
on Chemo Street.
Yeah, yeah.
And I heard Sonny Stitt there.
Yeah.
And I heard Johnny Hodges solo.
Yeah.
And all sorts of Roy Haynes and all sorts of people coming to town or living here. There was something there every night.
Yeah. You know, there's a place
Jimmy Slide, the dancer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we started something in about 2005 here at a place called Daryl's, which used to be called Bob the Chef's. Everybody knows it in Boston, right? When I was a kid, I used to go to Bob the Chef's and eat my hamburgers and greasy fries or whatever, right? When I come back here 25 years later as an adult, there's a young lady whose name is Esperanza Spalding, who is just a genius. She's, I mean, you don't want to throw that word around too much. But this person has made a huge impact on the industry today.
My thoughtless hand has brushed away and not I fly like thee or thou man like me.
She went to Berkeley. She's from, not from here, but she came here to go to school like all of us. And we decided to get together and do a thing at Daryl's. And then in that doing that thing, it had to do with a bunch of musicians coming together and having a weekly jam, jazz jam, on Monday nights, which everybody could come to. But it came out of this idea that you're talking about, which is having a local place where people exchange music and ideas for the local community. That's very important.
Can it be done?
Every city has to have 20 of them.
You know, it may be too late for the jazz joints, and the whole culture has changed. The sociology has changed. I love Eric Hobsbawm, great British historian who was a closet jazz nut and author, wrote a wonderful, wonderful series. He wrote brilliantly about music, but specifically about how important, he writes, how important it was to the development of the music was that floating, nomadic community of professional black musicians living on the self-contained and self-sufficient little islands of the popular entertainers and other night people, a street or two where the action was, rooming houses, bars, clubs, which were scattered like a Micronesian archipelago across the United States. Mm. We'd have to bring that all back.
Yeah.
He wrote about that era and that jazz, specifically the Basie Band, as one of the few 20th century arts that owed nothing to middle-class culture. Everything today, of course, is pitched for a commercial middle-class audience.
I mean, the great model for us in terms of the bebop era is Minton's. Minton's was run by musicians. They got the, that's where that model comes from. You got the Kansas City model for sure, but the New York East Coast model is Minton's. And that's where Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and
Thelonious
Monk and Dr. Billy Taylor, all of them hung out there, Mary Lou Williams. Minton's was a place that was run that one night by musicians, and they said, let's do it on Monday nights because everybody else is working, has gigs on another night. That'd be the night that's for us to experiment. Those are the, and then the people, Chris, enjoyed coming to hear not only the music, but guess what? This thing you talk about. They came to experience the community of musicians. See, that's what we're missing in culture. Everything is projected like the musicians on stage doing a performance. But no, that's not the magic moment. The magic moment is when musicians themselves. I think of 52nd Street.
Right.
You talk about the beboppers. You could go there and hear all the musicians. They were playing for the people, but they were also playing for who what? for themselves because they felt they were valued in those spaces. I mean, you got to think about that throughout the whole formula of wherever the musicians are doing their thing, the artists, that's where you want to be.
And they did it for a few super tuned white ears like Gunther Schuller. Yeah. And Harold Bloom, who went to Minton's,
and
claims to this day that he handed a copy of Hart Crane's collected poetry to Bud Powell, and that Bud Powell read it.
Yeah. Well, the beatniks were there, you see?
Yeah.
So the beatniks were into poetry, they were into realism, they were into the everyday. So Andy Warhol, after that, comes out in the later 60s of, you know, kind of everyday art being as special as museum art. And so those beatnik poets connected to the beboppers because they felt they were more aligned to the human impulse and the artistic impulse. So wherever that happens, that's where the people want to go.
Come back to the musicians as griots, as teachers in the community, and also what they are saying. My favorite book, as I might have told you, on jazz is Notes and Tones.
You love that book, I know, Notes.
Arthur Taylor, expatriated to Paris, interviewed all the great ones in the late 60s, 50 years ago. Yeah. But that's fascinating to me, Bill, because at this distance, it's clear what they were saying, among other things. They were in pain about the civil rights movement. They were in pain about the Beatles. They were in pain about the drug rap on all of them. They didn't like the word jazz. This goes through Monk and Miles and Errol Garner and Hampton Hawes and Carmen McRae and Sonny Rollins. I mean, all the varieties. But when you sift it out, they're race men and women, and they're also rights conscious.
They're rights conscious.
Terribly distressed about what was going on in our country.
Yeah, it does take time. And that book is wonderful, but then you go forward to Leroy Jones and the Black aesthetic and Black music. It does take 40 or 50 years, right? So you got to look back and you can't appreciate. Who are we going to interview today? Are we going to interview Jill Scott? Are we going to interview Maxwell and D'Angelo, who were doing these things in the 90s? I mean, it takes a while. And then we come up to a Kendrick Lamar. I mean, we can't interview Kendrick Lamar now because he's right in it. And it'll take 15 or 20 years to figure out, okay, what was the meaning of their work?
Exactly. What are we going to notice 50 years from now that Kendrick Lamar was saying?
Just as you were saying, it takes time. So looking at popular culture now, I don't know what it's telling us, all of what it's telling us, but I think it's important to have a dialogue about what it all means.
Bill Banfield, come back to your own Imagine Orchestra and the community feeling about it. It's quite remarkable, and it's not like anything out of the past. These younger, older, experienced, learning students even, somehow all gifted, somehow equal sort of,
it's
stars
global.
But no superstars.
Sure.
How do you find them, and what are the rules of the discourse here?
Well, we've got a Panamanian, we've got two Cubans, we've got South American artists, we've got people from all over America, we have someone from Japan.
Sounds like Dizzy Gillespie's United Nations big band.
Yeah, and having Chano Pozo in there from Cuba. I mean, it has that thing. Look, I'm excited about the new recording, which is about imagining a culture and a world and a voice and a perspective and a music that does these things. And that's the thing I want people to hear when they hear the music. I want them to hear a community of musicians who are both committed to craft and playing the construction of composition, but who have the gifting and the sense of community to share their voice and their energy. And I think that's what we have to do as artists. That's what we have to put out there.
We admire your band, Bill Banfield, and we count on you to help restore community for the rest of us in this town.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure to be with you today.
Thanks also to Regina Carter and Jonathan Singleton. Check our website for my visit with the Ghanaian griot and guitar master, Ku Nimo. And while you're there at radioopensource.org, sign up for our newsletter, subscribe to the podcast, leave a review on iTunes, and pay some dues for the best little band in radio. Our show this week was produced by the brass ensemble of Carnegillis, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Doné, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath keeps us all in tune on time. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us every time on Open Source.